I suppose one of the reasons why I'm kind of a bit interested in Tolkien at the moment is we can see Tolkien's process in operation in a way that we can't, of course, see in the writer of the Mabinogi. So so what we can see when we look at what Tolkien does is this. We can see the development of something that eventually, and he never really finishes his work. His work is, certainly his larger mythology is famously unfinished. It's in 12 books called The History of Middle-earth. And they created a sort of his son Christopher Tolkien created a condensation of that called The Silmarillion, which kind of pulls it all together. And so his mythology is found really in the Silmarillion, and the Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. Because we have his letters, because we have lots of stuff known about him, we have a sense of how he followed his own imagination, his own impulses. And we can do this also with people like David Jones. That's why the contemporary writers are quite helpful in some ways, because their lives are more known to us. We can have a sense of, how did they do this, and what was catching their attention. And one of the things that we see with Tolkien is the very first thing is this image of this angelic figure, but who is comes out of this very obscure Anglo-Saxon poem. And these, let's find the words again. Ialla Yarendil, Engla Beortast, of a midden garden Monum sended. O Yarendil, brightest of angels, sent to men above Middle Earth. So that's what catches it. And it's that thing where a line catches you, a line out of the past. You don't even really know what it means. And the language, at this point, he hasn't mastered Anglo-Saxon. He's learning Anglo-Saxon. He's really kind of interested in it, but he hasn't yet come to an understanding of it. The other thing he's interested in, and the two things he's interested in that feed his own imagination, is Anglo-Saxon ritual in general, Beowulf in particular, but also the Finnish saga of the Kalevala, which gets published really it's published in the early 19th century, and is a bringing together a regeneration of Finnish mythology. And I'm just going to read you a little wee bit of it. I am driven by my longing and my understanding urges that I should commence my singing and begin my recitation. I will sing the people's legends and the ballads of the nation. To my mouth the words are flowing and the words are gently falling, quickly as my tongue can shape them and between my teeth emerging. Dearest friend and much loved brother, best beloved of all companions, come and let us sing together. Let us now begin our converse, since at length we meet together from two widely sundered regions. Rarely can we meet together, Rarely one can meet the other in these dismal northern regions, in the dreary land of Poja. Let us clasp our hands together, let us interlock our fingers, let us sing a cheerful measure, let us use our best endeavours. While our dear ones hearken to us, and our loved ones are instructed, while the young are standing round us of the rising generation, let them learn the words of magic, and recall our songs and legends, of the belt of Wainamoinen, of the forge of Ilmarinen, and of Kaukomieli's sword point, and of Jokahainen's crossbow, of the Atlas bounds of Poja, and of Kalevala's heathlands. These my father sang aforetime as he carved his hatchet's handle, and my mother taught me likewise as she turned around her spindle, when upon the floor an infant at her knees she saw me tumbling, as a helpless child milk-bearded, as a babe with mouth all milky. Tales about the Sampo failed not, nor the magic spells of Louhi. Old at length became the Sampo, Louhi vanished with her magic. Vipunenen, while singing, perished, Lemminkainen in his follies. There are many other legends, songs I learned of magic import, some beside the pathway gathered, others broken from the heather, others wrested from the bushes, others taken from the saplings, gathered from the springing verdure, or collected from the byways. As I passed along as herd boy, as a child in cattle pastures, on the hillocks rich in honey, on the hills forever golden, after Murihiki the black one, by the side of dappled Kimno. Then the frost his songs recited, and the rain its legends taught me, and the songs the winds have wafted, or the ocean waves have drifted, and their songs the birds have added, and the magic spells the treetops. In a ball I bound them tightly, and arranged them in a bundle. On my little sledge I laid it. On my sledge I laid the bundle. Home upon the sledge I brought it, then into the barn conveyed it. In the storehouse loft I placed it, in a little box of copper. In the cold my song was resting, long remained in darkness hidden. I must draw the songs from coldness, from the frost must I withdraw them. Bring my box into the chamber, on the bench end lay the casket, underneath this noble gable, underneath this roof of beauty, shall I ope my box of legends. And my chest where lays are treasured, is the ball to be unravelled, and the bundled not unfastened. Then I'll sing so grand a ballad, that it wondrously shall echo, while the rye bread I am eating, and the beer of barley drinking. But though ale should not be brought me, though the beer should not be offered, I will sing, though dry my throttle, or will sing with water only, to enhance our evening's pleasure. Celebrate the daylight's beauty, or the beauty of the daybreak, while another day is dawning. I have often heard related, and have heard the song recited, how the nights closed ever lonely, and the days were shining lonely. Only born was Wainamoinen, and revealed the bard immortal, sprung from the divine creatrix, born of Ilmatar, his mother. Now, does that meter mean anything to anybody? Does it remind you of anything? Hiawatha took the Longfellow took the meter of the Kalevala from and used it for Hiawatha. That way around, yeah. Now, if we look at what's being said there in the beginning, the writer of this, who's Elias Lonrot, gathered together the Finnish traditions into a coherent set of legends. And in a way, what Tolkien was interested in doing was doing something similar. But he hasn't got much to work with, really, because actually there are not very many English legends. But one of the things, what he does, and then he does something that's also right at the heart of the Mabinogi. And then we also find in sort of 18th century and 17th century kind of folk tradition, he somehow realizes that the connection between human beings and the other world, and the sense of the connection between human beings and elves, is right at the heart of the a mythology of these lands. Now that sense of the human beings being connected to having, if you like, sort of an outer shape and an inner shape, sense of a connection between the human beings who die and these deathless figures that are the elves, starts to become really part of it, part of his understanding, really, of how the kind of that deeper kind of mythos works. And so what we start to see as he explores the Kalevala and as he explores Beowulf, he's growing up. He's a young man, but he has to go to war. What starts to happen really is that one of the things he says is that he gets very interested in the idea of fairy. The time he's looking at the beginning of the 20th century, when the whole idea of fairies have become these rather trivialized Peter Pan, Tinkerbell, Victorian diminutive figures. And one of the things that he's really kind of unhappy about is that this Victorian tradition has really broken our link with some of the deeper aspects of the imagination. So initially, when he starts writing, he is writing in that rather Victorian-esque tradition, and he quickly doesn't really like it. But a newer version of something that he writes in that way. I must follow in their train down the crooked fairy lane, where the coney rabbits long ago have gone. And where silverly they sing in a moving moonlight ring, all a twinkle with the jewels they have on. They are fading round the turn where the glowworms palely burn, and the echo of their padding feet is dying. Oh, it's knocking in my heart, let me go or let me start, for the little magic hours all are flying. Oh, the warmth, oh, the hum, oh, the colours in the dark, oh, the gauzy wings of golden honey flies. Oh, the music of their feet, of their dancing, gobbling feet. Oh, the magic, oh, the sorrow when it dies. Now, this is one of his very early kind of glimpses into fairy. And if we contrast it with something that he writes just a little bit later, when he's kind of a bit kind of fed up of all of that. East of the moon, west of the sun, there stands a lonely hill. Its feet are in the pale green sea. its towers are white and still. Beyond Taniquentil in Valinor, no stars come there but one alone that hunted with the moon. For there the two trees naked grow that bear night's silver bloom, that bear the globed fruit of noon in Valinor. There are the shores of Faerie, where their moonlight pebbled strand, whose foam is silver music on the opalescent floor. Beyond the great sea shadows on the margent of the sand that stretches on forever from the golden feet of Cor. Beyond Taniquentil in Valinor. For west of the sun, east of the moon, lies the haven of the star, the white tower of the wanderer, and the rock of Eglamar, where Vingalot is harboured, where Erendil looks afar, on the magic and the wonder between her and Eglamar, out, out beyond Taniquetel in Valinor, afar. That's got quite a different kind of feeling. Right, there's a sense of, sorry, this is, it's not twee, it's kind of a sense of this mysterious kind of place. We've got Erendil in there, we've got the sense of the shores of Faerie, we've got the sense of something that touches into the kind of human world. And what we find him doing initially really is exploring this sense of, well, what has happened to Faerie? And this sense of something that was really important to the Anglo-Saxons, the sense of elves. Now, he didn't invent elves, people think he invented elves. This is the whole thing about elves is this is absolutely important to Anglo-Saxon tradition. Not just Anglo-Saxon tradition, really, but of course also to Celtic tradition. And all over the world, this sense of these invisible creatures that share the world with us, that are in some ways cousins to us. We find it, if you look at Robert Kirk's Secret Commonwealth, where he talks about the traditions, you find it in the ballad materials, where we look at the ongoing relationship between humans and fairy beings. You certainly, as we see, find it in the Mabinogion, where you've got this interchange all the time between the beings of beings of Anuvin and this world. You find it in the Middle East, where we look at the jinn and humans. You find it in the far. You find it in Persia with the peris. You find it You find it in India. So right across the world, this sense of, we are accompanied by these invisible creatures, and the necessity and the need to find an accommodation, a way of relating to these figures. So and if we are not in good relationship with these figures, then things go wrong. In folklore stories, food gets spoiled, crops don't grow, milk, the cows stop giving milk, so the biggest story is the land becomes wasted, the sacred things get taken away from the land. And what this kind of then requires of us, really, if we're going to try and take this all very seriously, is that we take seriously our perceptions of these creatures, these beings, these people. Now, much later on in his life, he writes an article called On Fairy Stories, where he quite straightforwardly really addresses both the question of why fairy stories are important, and why the faculty of the imagination, which he calls sub-creation, is important, and what happens if we don't treat these things as important. I sent you all a draft. I admit it's not an easy thing to read. what he does in this story. And if we look at how he begins. I propose to speak about fairy stories, though I am aware that this is a rash adventure. Fairy is a perilous land, and in it are pitfalls for the unwary and dungeons for the overbold. And overbold I may be accounted, for though I have been a lover of fairy stories since I learned to read, and have at times thought about them, I haven't studied them professionally. I have hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder but not of information. The realm of fairy story is wide and deep and high and filled with many things. All manner of beasts and birds are found there, shoreless seas and stars uncounted, beauty that is an enchantment and an ever-present pebble, both joy and sorrow as sharp as swords. In that realm a man may perhaps count himself fortunate to have wandered, but its very richness and strangeness tie the tongue of a traveller who would report them. And while he is there, it is dangerous for him to ask too many questions, lest the gates should be shut and the key is lost. There are, however, some questions that one who is to speak about fairy stories must expect to answer or attempt to answer, whatever the folk of fairy may think of his impertinence. For instance, what are fairy stories, what is their origin, and what is the use of them? I'll try to give answers to these questions, or such hints of answers to them as I've gleaned, primarily from the stories themselves, the few of all their multitude that I know. And he goes on to, when he talks about the road to Fairyland, he actually quotes some lines from the Ballad of Thomas the Rhymer a little bit later on. "Well, see you not yon narrow road, so thick beset with thorns and briars. This is the path of righteousness, though after it but few inquire. And see you not yon broad, broad road that lies across the lily even. This is the path of wickedness, though some call it the road to heaven. And see you not yon bonny road that winds about the ferny brae. This is the road to fair elf land where thou and I must go." So what he's starting to consider in this story, which is really, when he's using the story in a way, that whole article is a real key to understanding his whole mythology and his whole... And what he's really about. He's like helping us find a way to look freshly at fairy in our time. So that in a certain sense, what he does doesn't replace any of the other versions of looking into the other world, and clearly. But one of the usefulnesses of his attempt is that he's the writing an early 20th century man grappling with the questions of being in fairy, grappling with very real life things. You know, he's a subaltern in the trenches. His closest friends all die. He nearly dies himself a number of times. He's ill with trench fever for a very, very long time, and he's invalided. The only reason he likely survived is that he was so ill. He was a signals officer in the war, so he was, which meant really that you're right up in the trench, frontline trenches, conveying messages back to headquarters, and signal officers were often targets of enemy snipers, because if you could destroy the signalers, you could break down the communications between the headquarters and the forward trenches, so you could render the army's assaults incoherent. So we could, of course, just think of it, oh well, he's just using this to dissociate, but actually there's a very real way in which he isn't. You know, he's really kind of, and when we come to look at his actual mythology and the amount of darkness and light in his mythology, can really see that he's trying to grapple with issues that are very like David Jones in his way, and many of the other writers around the around the First World War, who really are grappling with the notion of evil, of life and death, of why do things go wrong. And what he says really about the beginning part of it really, where he looks at the wrongness of the Victorian approach to fairy stories, and he goes back to some of the 18th century and 17th century traditions, where he looks really at things like the ballad tradition of Thomas the Rhymer, really where fairy beings are not these diminutive tree things, but are these powerful, magical kind of beings. And so he spends a good deal of time in this article really kind of deconstructing that, and also looking at things like he also differentiates it from things like from some of the science fiction attempts like the Time Machine or the First Men in the Moon or the H.G. Wells things, because he's saying that, well, these are all imaginative, they're powerful, they're interesting, but actually there is something particular really about the way in which fairy stories connect us to the deep imagination, and bring the past into the present in order to grapple with the present. He really looks as well about how this capacity in human nature really goes all the way through all traditions and across time. And he talks about one of the oldest stories ever in English in writing, which is the Egyptian tale of the two brothers. And he quotes from the two brothers, "I shall enchant my heart, I shall place it on top of the flower of the cedar. Now the cedar will be cut down and my heart will fall to the ground, and you will come to seek for it, even though you will pass 7 years in seeking it. But when you have found it, put into a vase of cold water, and in very truth I shall live." Now, he's using that little story there, partly to look at how fairy stories manifest over time. But fairy stories are related to a process of recovery, of consolation, and something that he calls eucatastrophe, which is the happy ending, not in the Disney sense, it more in a sense of resurrection. So the reason that the tale of the two brothers is important to him is that the tale of two brothers, this is a story about how the brother will live again. And so the sense of things get sort of implicit within what he says are true for fairy stories are things going wrong, things getting lost, but then things living again, things becoming resurrected. Now, of course, it's based upon his sense of his sense of spiritual connection, his sense of he's a Roman Catholic, he's a Christian, he, in certain sense, one of the things he says is that the story of Christ is the greatest fairy story, that involves that sense of death and resurrection within it. And then there's a where is it? We get a very helpful sense of his own personal visionary capacity. We find in his letters, writing to his son Christopher, November 1944. I'll just read you a bit of that. "Your reference to the care of your guardian angel makes me fear that he," inverted commas "he," because he knows it's not a he, "is being especially needed. I dare say it is so. It also reminded me of a sudden vision, or perhaps a perception, which at once turned itself into pictorial form in my mind." Now, what he means by a perception is a direct intuitive awareness, which is then translated into an image. And there's a way in which we get a glimpse, really, in this bit of writing here about his his own, the inner workings of his own psyche, really. Of a sudden vision of a perception which had once turned itself into pictorial form in my mind, I had not long ago, when spending half an hour in St. Gregory's contemplating the Blessed Sacrament. I perceived or thought of the light of God, and in it suspended one small mote, or millions of motes, to only one of which was my small mind directed, glittering white, because of the individual ray from the light, which both held and lit it. Not that there are individual rays issuing from the light, but the mere existence of the mote, and its position in relation to the light, was in itself a line, and the line was light. And the ray was the guardian angel of the mote. Mote being a speck, right? So it's a little tiny speck. And the ray was the guardian angel of the mote, not a thing interposed between God and the creature, but God's very attention itself personalized. And I do not mean personified by a mere figure of speech, according to the tendencies of human language, but a real finite person. Thinking of it since, for the whole thing was very immediate and not recapturable in clumsy language, certainly not the great sense of joy that accompanied it, and the realization that the shining, poised mote was myself, or any other human person that I might think of with love. It has occurred to me, and I speak diffidently, and have no idea whether such a notion is legitimate. It is at any rate quite separate from the vision of the light and the poised mote, that this is a finite parallel to the infinite. As the love of the Father and the Son, who are infinite and equal, is a person, so the love and the attention of the light to the mote is a person, both with us and in heaven, finite but divine, that is angelic. Anyway, dearest boy, I received comfort, part of which took this curious form, which I have, I fear, failed to convey. Except I have with me now a definite awareness of you, poised and shining in that light, though your face, as all our faces, is turned from it. But we might see the glimmer in the faces and persons as apprehended in love of others. So if we think of this vision, this image, that we, and if we think of the experiences, or the meditative experiences of stepping, we think of the experience of the teacher at the table, the presence in the mirror. What we are looking at really is, or potentially looking at, is that sense of this living presence that is the direct attention of the divine focused on our very particularity. And in a way, that's what Tolkien is relating to here. And in there's a way in which his whole writing really looks at the dilemmas of our time and how to find our way back into full relationship with that kind of living presence, and how to maintain ourselves within that place of living and loving attention, and how to allow that living light to come through us into the world. And one of the great tools and methods that he sees as important in that is the story that holds us, that contains us, that reorientates ourselves. Because what he says that ultimately a true fairy story does is it first of all enables a sense of recovery. Now, what that means is the sense of recovery from a restricted state of consciousness, the sense of ennui, maybe the sense of depression, the sense of worn downness by the difficulty of the world. And we're reminded here perhaps of the friend of Gunnar Lewis, who can sing Sospan Vach and knows the Neath 15, but doesn't have any way of connecting to something deeper, who isn't, like David Jones, able to peer through the crack and see the golden mystery being enacted in the dark. And so the point of the story, and all the stories really, but the point of the stories that Tolkien is starting to work out here and develop and hold up as a mirror to us, is that we start to recover from that embedded sense of lostness in materialism. But what he's seeking to do, and quite rightly I think seeking to do in this, is not doing this in a conventionally religious way. He's trying to awaken the capacities of the imagination. The sense which then brings us into that sense of the living image and the direct apperception, the direct relationship with the individualized presence of the angel that is seeking to guide us and to show us our place within the great field of attention, of divine attention. And so that we know ourselves as shaped in the living image of the divine, and therefore co-creating the world with the divine. Now, the sense of recovery, in a way, is the first stage of that process, where we start to recover, if you like, a deeper sense of ourselves. So the story, by jolting us, by giving us another image, another set of possibilities, enables us to kind of, by waking up our imaginations, starts to take us into another possibility. It starts to include the possibility of fairy within the everyday world, within the things that are presented to us. And what he goes on to say is the next thing that happens there is something called this escapism. Now, escapism is something that your therapists are all about. No, escapism is a terrible idea, dissociation. That isn't what he means. He means the escape from a restricted way of viewing the world, of coming into a bigger view of the world that doesn't avoid darkness, that doesn't avoid death, that doesn't avoid pain, but that actually it means we are held in a bigger place. Now, when we're working with the tree of life in the way that we are, when we're working with the house of life in the way we are, what we find happening to us is we're woken up into a bigger sense of ourselves and a bigger sense of the world. So this is both recovery and escaping from that. And what happens in that place is we receive a sense of consolation. Again, consolation is needed because of the hardness of the world. So when he talks about that joy he experiences, and that direct sense of being seen, of being personally seen, personally touched by that living light, it's not that it takes away the darkness. It doesn't mean he's still, you know, in his case, you know, he's lived through war. Many of his friends have died. It doesn't take away his sadness, his grief. It doesn't take away his worry for his son, who's serving in the armed forces in 1944. But it provides consolation. And that consolation ultimately takes us into the possibility of this idea he calls eucatastrophe, which is the opposite of catastrophe, which he describes as the mysterious happy ending and the unlooked for happy ending that is like the resurrection of Christ. Something that is an impossible act of grace. And that's a mysterious outlook. The reason it's not Disney-esque, because Disney-esque, everything has a happy ending in the most superficial way. The whole idea of catastrophe maintains within it the idea that something bad can really happen. And that is also part of the eucatastrophe. Lord of the Rings, for example, does end with the destruction of the ring. But Frodo is never happy again and has to go to the Isles of the Blessed. And yet it is a new catastrophe. It is the mysterious kind of happy ending. And we'll look tomorrow more in detail at some of the ways his legend develops. But in the beginning, really, what we have is this sense of fairy, and he writes a series of stories and images about somebody who's originally called Errol, whose name means one who dreams alone. And he's drawing directly on various Anglo-Saxon traditions in that. And then this figure later becomes Elfwain. And Elfwain is the Anglo-Saxon word for elf friend. Now, to be an elf friend is to be someone who brings together the human part of you and the elven part of you, who is, in a sense, between both worlds. And so in his very first iteration of his legend, there is a sense of Elfwain as this mariner who sails away from the shores that we know, who finds a place called Tol y Eriesa, that is the Lonely Isle in the far west. And then journeys across this island and comes to a mysterious cottage called the Cottage of Lost Play. And within that cottage, he encounters many other seekers. And within a room in that cottage, here's the Room of Tales, where the stories are told that keep the world in balance, that keep the world alive. And Elfwain, at a later point, carries on another journey through a doorway that is silver and gold, and takes him to an experience of something called the Two Trees. And this whole thing is found, the seeds of all this, are in this poem. East of the moon, west of the sun, there stands a lonely hill. Its feet are in the pale green sea, its towers are white and still. Beyond Taniquentil and in Valinor, no stars come there but one alone that hunted with the moon. This is Elfwain. For there the two trees naked grow that bear night's silver bloom, that bear the globed fruit of noon in Valinor. These are the shores of faery with their moonlit pebble strand, whose foam is silver music on the opalescent floor. Beyond the great sea shadows on the margin of the sand that stretches on forever from the golden feet of Cor, beyond Taniquentil in Valinor. O east of the moon, west of the sun, east of the moon, lies the haven of the star, the white tower of the wanderer and the rock of Eglamar, where Vingalot is harboured while Erendil looks afar on the magic and the wonder between her and Eglamar, out beyond Taniquentil in Valinor afar. Now this is part of something he calls the Lay of Erendil. And Erendil, this angel who takes us out of the shadow of death, who takes us into the sense of the divine, he starts to imagine as this mariner who takes us into the shores of faery, who takes us into this other world, and who he identifies with Venus as the morning star and the evening star. And in a certain sense, what we start to see here now is the development of the beginnings, really, of a mythology that has at its heart this sense of resurrection, this sense of recovery, escape, consolation and eucatastrophe. That doesn't in any way separate us from, you know, it's not a dissociated fantasy. It's asking us to somehow understand that the world is genuinely bigger than we know. So a world there that has room for the sense of the divine attention shining directly upon us, loving us and loving all, and the presence of Trump in the White House, of Putin in the Kremlin, of the bombs coming down on Gaza as we speak. It asks us to be big enough to envisage all that, to be part of all that, to realize that we are part, that our attention, our very attention, when we are aligned with the angel, when we are aligned with that deeper light, is potentially curative, potentially helpful, can reach out and touch all parts of the world. Now, as he carries on with his mythology, he, as I say, this, it's not like he's writing loads, you can't, in the trenches. He's making notes, he's creating odd poems. Let's see what else. So one of the poems he writes, really, you know, when he's coming back to England, being ill, and it's the Lonely Isle. It's part of this image of the Lonely Isle, that is in this magical kind of place, but it's also in a way England. O glimmering island, set sea girdled and alone, a gleam of white rock through a sunny haze. Or all your hoary caverns ringing with the moan of long green waters in the southern bays. You murmurous, never-ceasing voices of the tide, you plumed foams wherein the shoreland spirits ride, you white birds flying from the whispering coast and wailing conclaves of the silver shore. Sea-voiced, sea-winged, lamentable host, who cry about unharboured beaches evermore, who sadly whistling skim these waters grey and wheel about my lonely outward way. For me, forever thy forbidden marge appears, a gleam of white rock over sundering seas. And you are crowned in glory through a mist of tears, thy shores all full of music and thy lands of ease, old haunts of many children robed in flowers. Until the sun paced down his arch of hours, when in the silence fairies with wistful heart dance to soft airs their harps and viols weave. Down the great wastes and in a gloom apart I long for thee and thy fair citadel, where echoing through the lighted elms at eve, in a high inland tower there peals a bell. O lonely sparkling isle, farewell. You can hear in that the kind of the sadness, the the grief, the, you know, it's you know, in a way, his sense of how life is not happy, not kind of escapist. It's a, there's that sense of elegy in that sense of loss of his friends, loss of innocence probably as well, but still in a way seeing the importance of that image. Now, in a way, the first thing that he writes, really, from when he writes this pathology is something called the Book of Lost Tales. So this is where you see, if you want to look up, really, the place where you find the beginnings of his mythology. In this kind of raw form, it's important to look at it there, because that's where you start to see it. You see it kind of developing. What you have in the Silmarillion is, in a way, his much more developed sense of the mythology. And it's interesting. Just we've got 20 odd minutes, and I'm going to go back to his sense of the Silmarillion and the beginning of the Silmarillion, because that kind of links with his experience, really, of the guardian angel. So I'm just going to read you really the first part of the Silmarillion. Is called the Einu Lindendale. It's his kind of creation myth. It's called the Music of the Eini. The Eini are the angels, the creative spirits. They're equivalent to the archangels of the Kabbalah. There was Eru the One, so Eru is the divine, the one who in Arda is the world as we know it, is called Il-Uvatar. And he made first the Aenir, the holy ones that were the offspring of his thought. And they were forth within, before aught all else was made.